This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio. Today, it's a great honor to have back in the studio with me Amira Haas, a reporter for the Israeli paper Haaretz, who's won numerous Press Freedom Awards for her courageous reporting from the occupied territories where she lives. Amira Haas, welcome back to Progressive Radio.
Hi.
Last night, I heard you give a wonderful talk, but in that talk, you seemed to be a little bit despairing about your work, about the possibility of having a direct impact with your articles at this point in the occupation as compared to the impact you might have had a few years back. Why do you feel that way, and why do you keep writing then?
Yeah, maybe the same impact was the same. It was the same impact a few years ago. I was just eluding myself. But we write and write, and most of the things are being published, and I'm not the only one who writes about Israeli occupation. There are some other colleagues of mine, especially at Haaretz newspaper, who do write, and very religiously so. But things move forward. I've written so very often about, you could say, a system of apartheid roads, separate roads to Jews and Palestinians in the West Bank, where the Palestinian roads are inferior in quality and much longer, much less convenient, and the Jewish roads are all built on Palestinian land, of course, and are very convenient, very comfortable, very large. I've written about it since the very start, since the Israelis really started to plan the greed of those roads. And some people were appalled at the beginning. International community was appalled. Some Israelis were appalled. And it goes on. And it goes, and people accept it now as normal and as justified. And there are many other such cases. There are checkpoints that I wrote about, and checkpoints where soldiers are especially, for some reason or the other, they are especially rude, and they have their own, they invent their own rude attitude to the Palestinians. A part of the fact that checkpoints are an illegal one, another illegal measure of the Israeli occupation. And I've written about these checkpoints 5, 6, 10, 12, 20 times, and been harassing the army with my questions 100 times. And it repeats itself. So at a certain point, you say, you need more than writing in order to change things.
Well, what do you need?
Well, I think you need the common Israeli-Palestinian struggle, unarmed struggle against occupation. But this is a dream.
How far off is that dream? And why isn't there more nonviolent resistance going on?
There is a lot of nonviolent resilience or individual resistance of Palestinians. Actually, their whole life is a permanent row of acts of resilience and resistance, non-armed resistance against Israeli occupation, because the Israeli occupation excels at these bureaucratic details of tyrannizing your life. And this is what they have to face every day in order to keep sane and to keep going on with their life and to send children to school and to have their plans and to have their little plot of land plowed and sown, et cetera, and hundreds of other things or thousands of other things. So there is a lot of resilience on the individual level experienced by the collective. But there is no leadership which translates it into strategy. And you have, on the one hand, Hamas leadership in the Gaza Strip that were caught completely into the myth, which Arafat shared, by the way, of liberating Gaza and having a government of their own. And they really so much immersed in the wish to prove that Islamic rule is possible that they forget that they forget that actually they played into the hands of Israel by isolating Gaza from the West Bank.
I mean, let me just interrupt. I'm sorry. So elaborate on that. Why was that a myth, the liberation of Gaza? Why is it not liberated?
From the start, Arafat started this myth in 94 when he declared Gaza liberated. A part of the settlements that were inside Gaza, Gaza was, of course, subject to Israeli military laws and military regulations and military control. And even in 2005, this is after Arafat's death, even in 2005, after the disengagement from Gaza, still Israel has the effective control over Gaza. It has the control over the borders, over entry, exit, entry of people, of goods, of exit of goods and people. People cannot go and get their treatment. People cannot go and study abroad. So it's under complete Israeli, even more than ever. Also, Israel controls the population registry. So if people are not registered in the Israeli computer of the Ministry of Interior, they do not exist. There are a few thousands of people who by mistake over the years were not registered when they were born. They were born in the occupied territories and their parents, mostly Bedouin parents, did not register them or did not get their birth certificate. Now they cannot issue for them identity cards when they've reached when they've reached 16 or 17. So, because the Israelis would say, oh, they smuggled in from somewhere. So you have such minute control over Palestinian life that people do not realize. It's like the control that existed in every regime of every dictatorship. So this is Hamas. This is about Hamas and Gaza. In the West Bank, the PA, the Palestinian Authority, is still opting for the option of being nice to the Israelis and to the Americans. So being nice to the Israelis and Americans in order to get some gestures on the part of Israel and the Americans, of course, contradicts the idea of nonviolent or unarmed, I don't like to use the word nonviolent, unarmed resistance against the occupation.
The effort to be nice to the Israelis and the Americans doesn't seem to be paying off, though, does it?
It probably pays off to them personally, individually. They get certain privileges which render them into a nomenclatura. So they have very basic privileges. It's nothing big. It's the right to move around, and the right to go out and in the country without much harassment or hassle or trouble, and something which most of the Palestinians are deprived of. Or the right to be in the country, to move in the country between areas in the country, going to Jerusalem, for example. This is something which is a dream for most of the Palestinians. Jerusalem is more distant than Australia now for most of the Palestinians, East Jerusalem. So, and also this kind of freedom of movement allowed people of the Palestinian Authority and the entourage to expand their economy, private economy, economical enterprises, commercial enterprises. So I think this is partly, maybe some of them are convinced that being nice to the Israelis and to the Americans will eventually get them somewhere. But I think that 15 years are enough to tell us that this is not the way to get to liberation.
I'm speaking with Amira Haas. She's the prize-winning reporter for the Israeli paper Haaretz, who's been writing about and living in the occupied territories for many years. I'm Matt Rothschild. You're listening to Progressive Radio. You used a few minutes ago the noun apartheid to refer to the situation of the occupation and the analogy between that and apartheid South Africa. Now, Jimmy Carter used that and got in a lot of trouble, but you and has since discarded it, but you keep using it. Why?
First of all, apartheid is in Dutch or Afrikaans, as we all know, separation. That's what Israelis claim from the beginning of from the mid-90s. They claim that this is the goal, separation. Peres has even said that he is not in favor of geographical separation, but demographic separation. He didn't even shy at saying that. Demographic separation, and this is what is, and this is what is apartheid about. Demographic separation, which means you have two peoples who live in the same piece of territory between the river and the sea. And they're not subject to the same set of laws, rights, systems, education systems, health facilities, infrastructures, etc. On the contrary, one is getting the benefits of a very developed system of laws, of infrastructure, of health and education facilities. The other gets the inferior. Only one people has the right to vote for the government, which rules over the two peoples. So in that sense, you have demographic separation, which is apartheid.
Amira Haas, you got a question last night, and I'm sure you get this question a lot. What about terrorism? How does Israel, you know, Israel is getting, you know, hit by rockets, and Hamas, you know, has said some very lurid things about Jews in an anti-Semitic way, or about what it wants to do to Jews in Israel. They're an implacable enemy, some Israelis would say, and so Israel needs to defend itself, and that's what it's doing. Yeah. How do you respond to that?
First, I'm not sure I approve of the very term terror. Terror is about terrorizing, inflicting fear, so much fear by killing, by death threats, by death. And governments are doing this, states are doing this, and they are not called terrorist states. So we should be fair and not just decide, okay, putting tanks in the middle of a civilian neighborhood in Ramallah or Rafah is not terror. Okay, so other things are not terror either. Let's talk about killing, murdering, whatever. But let's leave aside for a moment the very term terror. True, Palestinians have resorted to killing Israeli civilians. Many of them. But Israel, before Palestinians killed Israeli civilians, Israel is the one who killed Palestinian civilians. So now, where do we start this egg and chicken game and the chicken? This is first. So I say, first of all, we should look who is imposing its rule over whom. And it's Israel who imposes a military rule over the Palestinians. And Israel is ruling Palestinians against their will. So I said I will not use the term terror, but this is the beginning of the problem. This is the origin. This is the original sin, if you want. And then there are a chain of reactions. Now I'm at odds. And I've written very often against Palestinian ways of fighting against Israeli occupation, in all their forms, in many of their forms. I think that Palestinians cling too much to symbolism very often. They think that holding a gun and being photographed holding a gun is enough to have an armed struggle. And then not to mention the suicide attacks against Israeli civilians. But all of it is, you know, the suicide attacks started in after the massacre in Hebron in February 94, a massacre committed by an Israeli American-born Jewish doctor. Before that, Palestinians and Hamas never killed Israel. I mean, never committed these horrendous suicide attacks inside Israel, mass attacks. There were sporadic attacks, sure. But, you know, also in the West, you feel that people remember the Israeli casualties. They don't remember the many Palestinian casualties. So the questions are always about the terror and much less about the Palestinian casualties. And indeed, we've stopped remembering all of them because there are so many. And even the Israeli army has to acknowledge that the great majority of casualties are civilians and not and civilians who were not involved in acts of fighting. But here I would like to tell a Jewish joke, if we have the time.
Sure.
There is this Jewish mother whose son has to go to the Tsarist Russian army in a war against the Turks at the end of the 19th century. She prepares his bag, and she's of course very worried, and he tells him, Shloimele or Moishele or whatever, please take care when you get to the front, just kill a Turk and take a rest. Don't tire yourself. So Moishele or Shloimele says, but mommy, what will happen if while I'm taking a rest, the Turk will kill me? So the mother says, Oy vey zmir, what does he have against you?
But the implication both of your analysis of the cycle of violence and of the Jewish joke is that if Israel were to accede to giving Palestinians a decent, just state, so there'd be a two-state solution, that the threat to Israel from Palestinians would go away. And a lot of Israelis and a lot of Jewish Americans don't believe that.
From knowing and having lived with Palestinians for so long, I'm sure that if Israel did not lose this golden opportunity 14 or 15 years ago and really started the real course towards peace, that is, froze all settlement activities and even dismantled many of the colonies before the final status, etc., I believe that Palestinians would have really been engaged in building up their future and a future of expanding their life, not shrinking their life.
But so Mira Haas, that was 14 or 15 years ago. What about now after this generation that has been raised on Israeli violence and, as you put it,
brutalization
last night, brutalization, and that the only Israelis they know are soldiers and settlers?
Yeah. Well, here it's very strange because here it seems that Israeli left-wing and Israeli activists have a very interesting role to play, because while breaking the Israeli orders of separating of the two peoples, and by getting to the Palestinian territory and having demonstrations and other activities with Palestinians against the wall, for example, or against checkpoints, they remind Palestinians very often that there are other Israelis.
And this gets to your point about the need for nonviolent, organized resistance, not only among Palestinians, but also among Israelis.
First, I don't use the term nonviolent because occupation is violent by definition, even when the occupation is benign or does not use weapons, or exist only through bureaucrats and civil administration, which gives permits and does not kill. So the violence here is in the system itself. I would say unarmed resistance.
And what is the how is the unarmed resistance within Israel?
Okay, here within Israel, it's of course different. I would say more civil disobedience. There is no widespread civil disobedience mentality. People would not dare now to break the military orders by the thousands and go into Palestinian territories where it's forbidden for Israel to stay, where the PA or the Palestinian Authority has some authorities. These zones where it's forbidden for Israelis to enter, they don't do it. I mean, some do it, but not thousands. And they are not smuggling thousands of Palestinians, friends, into Israel to defy the Israeli discriminative regulations and laws. But also Palestinians, in spite of what I said, in general, Palestinians do not envision now a struggle with Israelis, a common struggle. They envision more, or they are experiencing more, getting help from Israeli human rights organizations to get a permit, to get somebody out for medical treatment, etc. But not the concept of common struggle has not developed yet in the country, neither side.
Do you see that happening, or is that receding, that possibility?
I would say, with the logic of an activist, I would say it has to come. But I don't think that always logic of activists is proven to be right.
Amir Haas is a reporter for the Israeli paper Haaretz. I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive magazine. You're listening to Progressive Radio. One argument that you hear a lot is that Palestinians, or Hamas anyway, won't recognize Israel, and therefore there's no negotiating or dealing with Hamas or Hamas's followers. What is the importance of formal recognition?
Look, Arafat formally recognized the state of Israel, and what has it brought it him to? He didn't succeed in realizing all the promises, or fulfilling all the promises he gave to his people. Abu Mazen recognized the state of Israel as well as and so many others, and this doesn't change. Now, the issue is not also negotiations. Israel is happy to have negotiations forever, but negotiations should lead somewhere. And that's exactly what is happening, that they don't lead anywhere.
But, and that seems just odd to me from a long-term survival strategy for the state of Israel. It's also dangerous and detrimental to the United States as the chief patron of Israel. And I think it breeds anti-Semitism around the world because of the fact of the occupation and the pictures and the stories of the occupation that circulate. So what is the long-term vision of the leaders of Israel, the elected leaders of Israel?
This, you know, I'm speechless. I have no idea, because I sometimes, look, I analyze that they all hope to be able, in the long run, to, or in a way they are succeeding, to foil any possibility of materializing a solution based on international resolutions. That is the two-state solution along the 67 borders. So their aim was to completely dismember Palestinian territory, to disconnect Gaza from the West Bank, and actually to break this equation that the state is a Palestinian state is to be comprised of Gaza and the West Bank. And in a way, so far they have succeeded. But in the long term, I'm asking myself very often, do they really believe that we can always rely on our military superiority? Because this means always a low fire conflict, which sometimes gets higher, the fire gets higher, and then recedes. Do they really believe that it can last forever?
It's permanent occupation and permanent violence.
Permanent occupation, permanent violence of the occupation, permanent violence as reaction to the occupation. Sometimes times of tranquilizers or fatigue among the Palestinians, and then again the same vicious circle. But in the long run, something is bound to happen. Peoples in Egypt or Lebanon or Jordan will not always accept that their regimes are such obedient allies of America. Something might happen. Then they might address Israel, which they see sometimes they see Israel as the representative of America. Sometimes they see America as representative of Israel. In that way, in perpetualizing our military characteristics and functioning, we make ourselves an episode. Israel.
You make yourself a what?
An episode.
An episode.
A historical episode.
That's going to disappear.
That's my fear. An episode, not just as a state, but also as a community. I'm not talking about 30, 40 years, but in the long run, I mean, if you really study history, we have to understand that we cannot always exist in the region and fulfill missions which are hostile to the same region. This is my fear for the long run. Now, I'll tell you, some big shot Palestinians and mortal Palestinians, such as this farmer who is being arrested for years by a nearby settlement, asked me very same question. They asked me, tell me, Amira, don't Israelis think about their grandchildren? And I think it's a very compassionate and wise question.
You were discussing what Palestinians think about Israel, which is an interesting question. Is Israel a representative of America, or is America a representative of Israel? To what extent do you think Israel is an outpost of the U.S. empire and is supported by the United States because of its serviceability to the U.S. foreign policy?
I read just like anybody else reads, or I think that indeed Israel renders important services to the United States in terms of weapon, development of weapons, of security expertise, security knowledge, security development. I mean, I know that there are some Israeli, I guess there are many more than what I know, Israeli developments of weapons here in the United States and factories and enterprises. I think that sometimes that even our imagination does not grasp the volume of what Israel, of these security services that we are giving to the United States.
And there's an ugly dynamic that you have talked about, and that is that the more that Israel insists on permanent occupation and permanent repression, the more it becomes an expert at
yes.
these kind of tactics that the United States then adapts elsewhere.
Yes, yeah, yeah. And then if we are in a world where it's presented as the clash of civilizations, and we, the enlightened, enlightened civilization of the West are fighting the backward and the dangerous and terrorist civilization of Islam. So we need all this expertise, which is being developed only in conditions of adversity and hostility as it is under occupation.
And Amira Haas, what is the fallacy of that clash of civilizations formula?
You want. First of all, there are many more. I mean, those who object to American or to empire or to the rule, to the hegemony of the West and hegemony of the white men, are many more than just a few Islamic, people wandering in the desert. So this is the first, and we have South America now. We have people also inside America and inside Europe who oppose the main components of America, of Western Empire. This is one. Another thing that also Islam has thousands of different tones and expressions, etc. I don't think it's a matter of civilization. It is a matter maybe of also... Unfortunately, those who represent now the greatest opposition to the West, I do not believe that they adhere to emancipatory ideologies. So we have a problem here.
Well, we need to get back to those emancipatory ideologies and practices. Unfortunately, we're out of time. Amira Haas, thanks so much for being my guest today.
Thank you.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.